Chapter 10. Thinking Like a Physicist. On Honesty and Doubt. I want to share with you what I think is an interesting story. In 2017, I presented a documentary for BBC Television called Gravity and Me, in which I explored how our understanding of this fundamental concept that shapes our world has evolved throughout the history of science, from an invisible Newtonian force to the structure of space-time itself. What made the project even more fun was that we developed a smartphone app that monitors its users' location by recording their GPS coordinates, latitude, longitude, and altitude above sea level, at regular intervals. It then uses this information to calculate the rate at which time is passing for the user. According to general relativity, time flows at different rates depending on the strength of the gravitational field at that location. Someone on a mountaintop is further away from the center of the Earth than someone at sea level, and so the mountain dweller feels a very slightly weaker gravitational pull by the Earth. This means that time up on the mountaintop runs ever so slightly faster than at sea level. It's a tiny effect, less than a trillionth of a second faster for each second that passes down at sea level. So, even if someone spent all their life at the top of the mountain, all other factors being equal, impossible I know, they would live for about a millisecond less than they would have if they'd spent their life at sea level, as measured by a very accurate but otherwise useless hypothetical clock floating out in space. Compared with the far greater benefits of breathing clean mountain air or a healthy diet and regular exercise, this advantage is somewhat pointless. Still, the physical effect is real, and the app was a bit of fun. To create the app, we had to take another factor into consideration. As I discussed in Chapter 3, moving clocks run more slowly than stationary ones. So you can slow your time down relative to someone standing still by moving. This is an even smaller effect than the one due to gravity, as we don't tend to move about at anywhere near the speed of light where the effect becomes appreciable. Nevertheless, the app took motion into consideration by checking the user's position at regular intervals, and if he or she had changed location significantly, it could work out how fast they had travelled. Now, here's the crucial bit. Our planet is not a perfect sphere. It bulges out at the equator. So someone standing at the equator is further from the centre of the Earth than someone at the North Pole, by about 22 kilometres. And so, like the mountain dweller, they should feel a slightly weaker gravitational pull. Therefore, clocks at the pole, where gravity is stronger, should be ticking ever so slightly slower than those at the equator. This is called general relativistic time dilation. However, the Earth is also spinning, and clocks at the equator are moving faster than clocks at the pole, as measured by the adjudicating clock floating out in space. So, equator clocks should tick more slowly than pole clocks. Special relativistic time dilation. These two effects, due to special and general relativity, work against each other. So, which one wins? Which clock is ticking more slowly? I calculated these two effects separately and found that a clock at the pole ticks overall more slowly because it feels stronger gravity, despite the clock on the equator moving faster. All of this cool mathematical information was incorporated into the app, which implemented my formulae. An enthusiastic social media campaign meant that we persuaded thousands of people to download the app and use it before the program aired. We even received video diaries from a number of people, such as a pilot and a mountaineer, who provided a record of their app's results. Then we hit a snag. My very smart producer, Paul Sen, called me one evening, a week before the editing of the program was scheduled to finish, and just before I was due to record the voiceover, for an anticipated transmission on the BBC soon after that. He said he'd been reading through some material on an online physics forum, which suggested that I might have screwed up. I immediately dropped what I was working on and went back to consult my calculations. I also quickly emailed half a dozen colleagues to check what I had done. I had indeed made a very basic mistake. The two effects, the slowdown of time at the pole because it feels stronger gravity, and the slowdown of time at the equator because it's moving faster, cancel out exactly. In fact, all clocks at sea level tick at the same rate everywhere on Earth, and the time they measure is called International Atomic Time, IAT. The surface of the Earth is a geoid, an equipotential gravitational surface on which the cancellation between the two effects, due to special and general relativity, is not a coincidence. When our planet first formed billions of years ago, hot and malleable, its spin forced it into a more stable, bulged-out, oblate shape, thus ensuring that all points on its surface are sitting in the same gravitational potential. So time flows at the same rate everywhere, provided it is measured at sea level. Climb higher and your time speeds up. Go down below Earth's surface and it slows down. The numbers that were being produced by my app were wrong, and the formulae had to be corrected. But the problem was more serious than that. I had explained how the app works in the program, and my mistake was there for all to see. The documentary couldn't be broadcast in its current form. I told my producer, who immediately asked the BBC to delay transmission. The easiest solution would, of course, have been to reshoot the scenes in which I'd made the mistake. No one would be any the wiser. But I quickly realized that this gave me a wonderful opportunity to show how real science works. Instead of covering up my blunder, I should come clean about it, to show that in science, it's okay to make mistakes. So we shot some new scenes in which I confessed my error in all its glory and explained why I'd been wrong. This admission didn't require any particular courage or strength of character on my part, since making mistakes is normally the way science progresses. They are inevitable, and we learn from them. After all, if we didn't make mistakes, how would we ever discover anything new about the world? This is where science differs from, say, politics. I mean, how often do you hear politicians admitting unequivocally that they are wrong? The history of science is full of examples of learning from the mistakes of the past, with new hypotheses and theories replacing older ones as our understanding of the workings of nature grows or new empirical evidence becomes available. But how do we explain to wider society the value of this approach? Forming a hypothesis, testing it, then rejecting it if it doesn't fit the data. This is all a far cry from so much of public discourse taking place today, particularly on social media, where the loudest voices tend to be from those who value personal opinion and preconceived prejudice over evidence, reproducibility, and rigor. Is there then a lesson that scientists can teach society? Or would we just be accused of arrogance and elitism? Another trait closely related to our obsession with honesty and almost unique to scientific research is the importance of doubt. This trait can sometimes be our own worst enemy when it comes to explaining to wider society how science works. We state that we can never be completely certain about something, that a scientific theory is only our current best guess at an explanation, and that as soon as this theory conflicts with new observations or data, we must be prepared to revise or discard it for something better. But some people then say, if you're not sure of anything, how can we trust or believe anything you tell us? Without certainty, what can we cling to? This response is understandable. It is in our nature to want to know for sure, not just to have some temporary best guess. But to think in this way is to misunderstand how science progresses. The trustworthiness of science comes not from certainty, but from its very openness about its uncertainty. Always calling into question what we currently understand and being prepared to replace that knowledge with a deeper understanding if something better comes along. In other walks of life, this attitude might be regarded as fickle, but not in science. Scientific progress depends on scientists' unwavering commitment to the qualities of honesty and doubt. Here is another example of the way scientists think that might come as a surprise to you. People are often shocked to hear that many physicists, other than those who had dedicated years of their lives to building the Large Hadron Collider, were hoping that the Higgs boson would not be found. You see, not finding the Higgs would have meant that there really was something wrong with the Standard Model, opening the door to exciting new physics. Merely ticking a box to confirm something we already suspect to be true is just not as exciting as finding out that one needs to pursue hitherto unexplored paths of research. On the other hand, we physicists are sometimes accused by well-meaning but amateur scientists of not being open-minded enough to entertain their new theories, such as claims that they have found some flaw in Einstein's relativity. The truth is, I would love for Einstein to be proven wrong, for that would mean we'd need a new and better theory to replace his, just as general relativity improved upon Newtonian gravity. But physicists have been relentlessly checking, prodding, and poking Einstein's ideas for a century now. And still, relativity theory keeps coming through with flying colours. A better theory may one day be discovered, of course, explaining everything that relativity does and more. But we have yet to discover it. And so, as part of our ongoing, centuries-long efforts to find ever more fundamental explanations of physical phenomena, we keep trying to tear down our existing theories, to test them to destruction. If they survive, then we trust them, until something better comes along. On theory and knowledge. When, in general conversation, someone says they have a theory, what they tend to mean is that they have an opinion on something, a view that may be based on some form of evidence or observation, but equally well one that is no more than a guess, or a hunch based on ideology or prejudice or some other belief system. Such a theory, which may or may not turn out to be correct, is very different from what we mean by a scientific theory. I'm thinking here of theories in the natural sciences rather than, say, in economics or psychology, which also, of course, may or may not be correct, but which, in contrast to a mere opinion, must satisfy a number of important criteria. Firstly, it must put forward an explanation of what we observe, either in nature or in an experiment, and provide evidence for that explanation. Secondly, a scientific theory must be verifiable in accordance with the scientific method. It must be testable, and those tests or observations have to be repeatable. Finally, a good scientific theory makes new predictions about aspects of the world it explains, which can then also be tested by further observations or experiments. Our most successful scientific theories, such as relativity, quantum mechanics, the Big Bang theory, Darwinian evolution, plate tectonics, or the germ theory of disease, have all undergone rigorous scrutiny and have all emerged as the best explanations we have. None of these can be dismissed, as one often hears, particularly regarding Darwinian evolution, as just a theory. Such a statement ignores what it means for a scientific theory to be successful, that it has explanatory power, that it's backed up by evidence, and that it makes predictions that can be tested, and yet it remains falsifiable, in the sense that if observations or experimental results contradict its predictions, then it cannot be a correct theory, or at best cannot be the whole story. How then should we counter those who wish to undermine science and the scientific method, those who claim that their opinion should be valued above evidence, and that their theory should be given as much credence as the scientific theory it purports to challenge or dispute, without the need to be held to the same standards? While we might find it amusing that some people believe the Earth to be flat, or that the Apollo moon landings were a hoax, or that the world was created just a few thousand years ago, what about the people who hold views that not only go against established science, but which are genuinely harmful to society? Such as those who deny anthropogenic climate change, those who refuse to vaccinate their children because they believe in a baseless link between MMR and autism, or those who prefer magic and superstition to modern medicine. I find it frustrating that I don't have a clear answer to these questions. I've devoted half my academic career in physics to my research, trying to understand for myself how the universe works. The other half I've spent teaching, communicating, and explaining what I've learnt. So I cannot simply absolve myself of any responsibilities to engage and debate scientific issues with the wider public. Many of these issues are too important not to address. But I also know how hard it is to shift someone's strongly held views on a matter, however misguided I believe they are. In a very real sense, conspiracy theories are the polar opposite of scientific theories, in that they seek to assimilate whatever evidence there is against them and interpret it in a way that supports rather than repudiates their core idea, thus making them unfalsifiable. Many who hold such views will always try to interpret and favour evidence in a way that confirms their pre-existing hypotheses. This is known as confirmation bias. Often in the case of ideological beliefs, we also hear the term cognitive dissonance, whereby someone will feel genuine mental discomfort when confronted with evidence supporting a view contrary to their own. This potent combination of confirmation bias and the avoidance of cognitive dissonance works to reinforce pre-existing beliefs. So trying to persuade someone in this frame of mind with scientific evidence can often prove to be a waste of time. Many people facing an avalanche of widely different views through both the mainstream and social media understandably find it difficult to know what to believe. How can they tell accurate, evidence-based information from fake news? One thing scientists can do is to tackle the issue of false balance. Thus, when almost every climatologist in the world acknowledges that the Earth's climate is changing rapidly due to humankind's activities and that something needs to be done urgently if we are to prevent its catastrophic consequences, the news media does not need to have a climate change denier provide the other side of the argument. Because when this happens, the public is left with the impression that both points of view are equally valid. Apart from the weight of scientific evidence in their favour, the difference between someone arguing that anthropogenic climate change is real and another denying it is that the former really hopes that he or she is wrong. A scientist will always admit that maybe climate change is not happening, maybe evolution theory is wrong, or relativity is wrong. Maybe gravity won't always pull me down to the ground, and through meditation I should be able to levitate. But these maybes do not mean we don't know. We do know that we will continue to test our theories, and if they hold up, we trust them and talk about them with non-scientists. But as scientists, we are prone to expressing ourselves in terms of honesty and doubt. Just as the word theory has a different meaning in science compared with everyday conversation, so too does the word certain mean something particular to scientists. Deep down, of course, I am actually quite certain that it's impossible to overcome the force of gravity through meditation in order to float off the ground. I'm also certain that the Earth is round, that it is billions of years old, and that life evolves. Am I certain that dark matter exists? Almost. On truth. I've often heard it said that there are different ways of getting to the truth, or indeed that there are different sorts of truth. No doubt a philosopher or a theologian reading this will regard my simplistic physicist views on the matter as hopelessly naive. But for me, absolute truth refers to what is real and what exists independently of human subjectivity. So when I talk about science as being the quest for truth, I mean that scientists are constantly trying to get as close as possible to the ultimate nature of things, to an objective reality out there waiting to be discovered and understood. It can sometimes feel as though this objective reality is nothing more than a collection of facts about the world that we discover slowly until we know them all. But remember that in science we can never claim to know something for certain. There's always the chance that, at some later time, we'll arrive at an even deeper understanding, taking us closer to that ultimate truth we seek. In practice, there are many ideas and concepts in science about which we've reached such a level of confidence that we can safely regard them as facts. If I jump off a roof, the earth will pull me downwards, and I pull it upwards ever so slightly, according to a simple mathematical relation that is as close as we will ever get to a statement of fact. We do not yet know everything there is to know about gravity, but we do know its effect on objects in our world. If I drop a ball from a height of 5 meters, I know, without having to check with a stopwatch, that it will be in the air for 1 second before it hits the ground. Not 2 seconds or half a second, but 1 second. One day we may find a new theory of quantum gravity, but it will never predict that my ball will take twice or half as long as Newton's equation of motion predicts. That is an absolute truth about the world. There is no philosophical argument, no amount of meditation, no spiritual awakening or religious experience, or gut instinct or political ideology that could ever have told me that a ball dropped from a height of 5 meters would take 1 second to hit the ground. But science can tell me. In a sense, then, the remaining gaps in our understanding of the laws of the universe, the nature of dark matter and dark energy, whether inflation theory is correct, the right interpretation of quantum mechanics, the true nature of time, and so on, are not going to change our understanding of the forces, matter, and energy that make up our everyday world. Future advances in physics aren't going to render what we already know obsolete. They will just refine it and give us a deeper understanding. Physics is human. In the end, physicists are like everyone else. We want our ideas and theories to be correct, and we'll often defend them in the face of emerging evidence to the contrary. Even the most brilliant physicists have been known to downplay problems with their theories and to amplify their criticisms of a rival idea. Confirmation bias exists in science just as it does in all walks of life, and scientists are not immune to it. We strive for tenure and promotion, to compete for funding, meet project deadlines, publish or perish, and work hard to gain the respect of our peers and the approbation of our superiors. And yet, part of our training in the scientific method is to develop humility and honesty in research, to enable us to act against our baser instincts. We learn not to be blinded by our desires or misled by our biases and vested interests. It's sometimes hard to see this if you focus on individuals. And there have been a number of well-documented examples of fraud and corruption in scientific research. But as research communities, we have built-in corrective procedures, such as the peer review of scientific papers. And yes, I know this is not an ideal way to evaluate research. And we rigorously train young scientists in the ethical and responsible conduct of research. This means that the scientific method is, by its very nature, self-correcting. It demands repeatability and the continued honest and critical assessment of ideas. Weak theories die out eventually, however hard their advocates try to keep them alive. And even if it sometimes takes a generation or two to free ourselves from the hegemonic shackles of a particularly dominant theory that has passed its sell-by date. The best physicists are often those who've been able to zoom out and free themselves from the prejudices of consensus, fashion, or reputation, even their own. But this is more likely to happen when a theory is already known not to be the final word on a subject, or if there are rival theories, each with its own staunch advocates. And remember that physics, just like all science, is not a democracy. All it takes is one new experimental observation to bring down a widely accepted theory and replace it with a new one. Thereafter, it's the new theory that must constantly justify itself by being held up against the bright light of observational data. Many of the more speculative ideas in fundamental physics today, some of which I described in Chapter 8, might be considered as failing to meet the requirements of what constitutes a proper scientific theory, because they cannot be checked against experiments. Among these, I would include, for now at least, string theory, loop quantum gravity, black hole entropy, and multiverse theories. And yet, thousands of theoretical physicists around the world are carrying out intensive research in these subjects. Should they stop working in these areas because their theories can't yet be tested? Are they wasting public funds that could be better poured into more useful areas of research? And what drives these physicists on if they've no way of testing their theories? Are they being blinded by the beauty of their equations? It's certainly true that a few physicists have even gone so far as to claim that they do not need to test their theories against data, but only against each other, for mathematical consistency and elegance, which strikes me as a dangerous road to go down. However, being too harsh on these searchers in the dark can also show a lack of imagination and appreciation of the history of ideas in science. When Maxwell wrote down his electric and magnetic field equations and derived from them the wave equation for light, no one knew, not even Maxwell himself, how this knowledge would be used by Heinrich Hertz, Oliver Lodge, Guglielmo Marconi and others to develop radio. Nor did Einstein anticipate, when developing his theories of relativity, that they would one day be used to give us accurate satellite navigation, which you access using the technological wonders crammed into that supercomputer in your pocket that would have been impossible without the abstract speculations of the early quantum pioneers. So the inflationary cosmologists and the string theorists and the loop quantum gravity researchers continue on their quests, and rightly so. Their ideas may turn out to be wrong, or they may change the course of human history. Or we may have to wait for another Einstein, perhaps even an AI, to help us out of our current confusion. We cannot yet say, but what we can say is that if we ever stop being curious about the universe and investigating how it and we came to be, then that is when we stop being human. The human condition is bountiful beyond measure. We've invented art and poetry and music. We've created religions and political systems. We've built societies, cultures, and empires so rich and complex that no mere mathematical formula could ever encapsulate them. But if we want to know where we come from, where the atoms in our bodies were formed, the why and how of the world and universe we inhabit, then physics is the path to a true understanding of reality. And with this understanding, we can shape our world and our destiny.